Hello and welcome to episode 250, the quarter millennium of the Comedian's Comedian podcast, the only podcast about comedy. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today, to celebrate this, whatever it is, a 250th, and there's probably some sporting word that I don't understand because it's to do with sport, but to celebrate this auspicious occasion, there could be no finer guest than Simon the Patrician Evans. He is someone who I was watching at the beginning of my career as he just destroyed night after night, and I'd watch their mouth agape, relishing the incredible richness of his writing, the complexity of the tone of his... When people talk about a comedian having an angle, someone like Simon just has found ground for himself. He's found a voice that is absolutely honest to an element of his character, and every word he says, there's no space in between any of his punchlines. It's all just imbued with this incredible tone that lifts what are already exceptionally good writing, exceptionally good jokes, into something else again. And we'll talk a little bit about the sort of seniority of act that can be achieved. And we'll talk about, so many things. We'll talk about how his life is at odds with his comedy persona. We'll talk about how he continues to evolve. And that's something I'm particularly impressed with, how Simon has... He's continually reinventing himself and now touring, and he's got a radio show on Radio 4, Simon Evans Goes to Market, which I highly recommend as well. And there's a bunch of... this is a decent long episode, and we'll talk about politics as well, because Simon's someone who people often pigeonhole as a conservative comedian. We'll talk about how that isn't accurate, and actually we'll delve into a little bit about what is accurate about his political stance and the extent to which he uses it or expresses it on stage. And this is just a really lovely episode. I'm so proud of it. Thank you for... But I don't need to do all this now. It's only the introduction. But I'm so excited to be celebrating episode 250 in the company of such an erudite, charming, intelligent, and very funny man. This is Simon Evans.
I tended to have an opening passage which would usually be built around a sort of cheerfully brazen prejudice expressed towards a sort of, not an ethnic minority, more like a regional thing. So you were playing with that kind of just on the edge of what was acceptable in political correctness. So in the 1970s, it would have been racist comedy. Now it was like, no, this is just about Geordies, it's my family. But and that would just expand. And then there was one about the Welsh that came into the second, which was initially supposed to be a routine that was kind of decrying the casual racism expressed towards the Welsh. And then it gradually became an example of that. So this is a very good illustration of the fact that we often have less control over what comes out of our mouths than we think we do.
But, and that routine, I should say, is available on... that's certainly... What's it called on YouTube? It's called... It's like three men and a baby joke or something.
The three men joke, yeah, that's in... Three babies joke. That is on YouTube. That's under my Edinburgh Gala performance, I think. And then the Geordie routine, a slightly slimmed down version of it, was done on the Michael McIntyre Roadshow. So gotcha. They were all eventually got out there. And they are on YouTube, yeah. Which is partly why I had to move on. I mean, that's quite a useful discipline, that once stuff gets onto the telly, you think, oh, I suppose I better write something new now, because otherwise, I think most of us would quite happily get away with it, on using the same.
I think for comics of your age and experience, you sort of get two sorts of comics. You get people who were hacking around the same 40 minutes for 20 years, it might have been an incredible 40 minutes. And I don't mean people like Noel Britton, who specialised in precisely the same 40 minutes. I mean people who would kind of, who a few years ago would still be turning in the kind of commercial club Friday night set that they would have done 10 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you've got those people who I imagine have dropped off. They're less on my radar now, or they're still working in different circumstances. And then you got the acts like yourself who transformed, who kept kind of learning and growing and doing.
I mean, I stayed in the same place for longer than I should have done or wanted to, partly I think because I got married, had children, moved out of London, and that all became that was quite chaotic, and it didn't go that smoothly. We moved house about seven times in about 4 years. and you know, not intentionally and so on. And I felt like my comedy was actually like one of the solid things that I could turn to in that time. Okay. You know, I kind of, at least when I got on stage, I knew what was going to happen. You know, it was sort of a reliable, safe place almost. And I did, I gradually became aware that a lot of acts, my contemporaries, had moved on to the touring circuit. And also that, you know, that they were, a lot of them were developing a panel show game as well, as it were, you know, almost like a separate persona or a tactics.
Obviously, rather than developing their own show, but developing their version of themselves
game,
on a panel show.
Exactly, yeah. You know, gaming, those skills. And I just sort of, I mean, I was, you know, like, as you suggest, I don't think there's anything remotely ignoble in just being a superlative 20-minute club performer. And when I got to the point where I could close the comedy store, I did kind of feel like I was at the, that was the top of the tree as far as I'd understood it to be. You know, I really wasn't thinking in terms of being a touring theatre performer. I used to write with Sean Locke. He'd have me to write with him for 8 out of 10 Cats. And it was his kind of, he kind of goaded me, really. He sort of said, you have to move on because otherwise you will just, you know, you'll just calcify. You don't really, I don't think he used that word, but you'll become stagnant. You know,
when was that? How long ago was that?
That was about the time that we were moving to Brighton, actually. So that was 2006, 2007. Okay. And it took me a little bit longer even after that to actually get on and do it. But maybe actually it was shortly after that. Yeah, I was making the train journey, that's right. And anyway, it was, I mean, there were various little incidents that kind of just pushed me off, you know, but I'm not one of those people who strides off purposefully to the next thing, you know. I am one of those people who has to be heaved out of his nest by the bigger bird, you know, of fate, forced to, you know, take flight before the whole thing falls apart underneath you.
That's funny. That seems at odds with your persona.
Yeah. Oh, well, my whole life is at odds with my persona in that respect. I mean, not in all respects, but in terms of being kind of, you know, almost military in my self-discipline and routines and no-nonsense approach to getting the important things in life done. I'm terrible. I mean, my persona, as with a lot of comedians, I think is partly all the things I'm terrified of becoming and also partly all the things I wish I could be. You know, it's a weird, it's not a truthful reflection at all, except possibly in the odd aside, you know, but...
except possibly in the...
In the odd aside, you know, that you just mutter under your breath.
Oh, the odd aside, sorry, yes.
Yeah, but, you know, behind, you know, sotto voce. But I think there's a kind of inertia to me, and increasingly, as I say, I think when you're younger and you have no dependence and you feel like you have endless stamina and you feel like you're going to live forever, you can take risks, you know, and you think, if this, I might just invest 6 months of my time, and if this doesn't come off, so what, you know. Whereas now I am, you know, fairly risk averse. Just if I can make this work, I'll stick with it.
Does that, just coming back to the differences between the persona and yourself, does that mean that your current beard is a costume that you...
No, the beard is just laziness. I just don't like shaving, really.
And no, I mean, it's a very military beard.
Right.
It's one of the the denoters, I think, of your transformation.
Well, sometimes it gets longer and quite bushy, and then my wife gets angry. When it starts to sort of be wider at the chin than I am at the head, you know, and it gets fully Uncle Albert, then she gets quite cross about it. But, I mean, I think partly I grew the beard when I realised I was going to have my head essentially shaved, because I just don't... I haven't got the right head for... just having fully exposed flesh, you know. There needs to be some sort of architecture.
So to come back to this conversation you had with Sean Locke,
who
I'd love to have on this show, but I received an email from his management, which I interpreted to mean, and I don't think I'm talking out of school here, I interpreted it to mean, we're not letting him come on the show.
Right, okay.
Which is quite an interesting thing to think about. To come back to that kind of... How did you feel when he said that?
Well, I just remember him. He'd been touring. I probably had asked him about it, you know, and he had probably sensed that I was kind of tentatively probing the notion that I might be able to tour. But he said, I remember the conversation where he said, you've got to accept the fact that there will probably be a lurch. You might, you know, your income might drop for a year or two. You know, if you organise your diary well, and this was, again, 10 years ago when there were probably more comedy clubs, you could earn quite a decent living just doing your club 20s. And you could pack three or four into a Friday and Saturday night. You know, you could earn a decent living. And you know, you go out and tour the first time. I remember Lee Mack, who I was working with at that time, you know, the first time he toured, he was getting audiences in, you know, the low 20s sometimes to some of the art centres, you know, that he did. And then he did one appearance on Live at the Apollo, I think, and sold out his next tour sort of almost overnight. You know, you have to have some conviction that you've got the product, but you also have to have a bit of luck to sort of, you know, turn the tap on. Anyway, I mean, it was just a sort of, it was a, sooner or later you're going to have to either, you know, move up or move out kind of thing, because you have that sense that there are new young acts coming up beneath you, you know, all the time. The club scene expanded for the first sort of 10 years of my life, of my comedy life. Mm-hmm. Between 96 and 2006, there were always more clubs coming. And I think there was as much new stage available as there were comedians to fill it. But when that dynamic started to shift, you know, when you started to feel that Jonglers was in trouble and one or two other clubs had stopped doing their late show and stuff, and you could just feel it tipping the other way. And a part of it, obviously, was that more comedians were touring, and so some of the money that the public have available to go and watch live comedy was going into those you know, venues rather than into the clubs. And so you feel, well, I need to be able to, you know, adjust. I mean, that makes it sound very clinical, but as much as a sort of as much as the growth of myself as a creative performer, I would have been quite happy in a way. The club circuit is, you know, is a great thing. And I honestly still think if you want to, you know, bang for your comedy buck, you can't do much better than a really good club night. Three great comics and a compere doing their best 20s. If you haven't seen them for a while, you know, it's fantastic. You know, the constant change of direction and pace and tone and persona is, that's a big night out. You know, you come back, you know, properly aching, you know, with laughter after that. You know,
I've been really focused on my own touring for the last 3 years. I'm just coming to the end of my third tour, and it is great to be reminded of how great the club scene is.
They are. They're really good. The only sad thing is that, you know, a lot of good comedians now, as soon as they get good enough to deliver a really good 20, they then start touring, thinking that that's what they have to do. And in reality, you know, to go and see somebody doing their first hour or an hour and a half on tour, and that's your only entertainment for the night, you know, you probably won't laugh as much as you would have done them and three others doing their best 20s, you know. That's just, it was harsh, but it's true, you know.
I'm going to strike that from the record. I need to sell tickets.
you might get a more memorable insight into a certain kind of worldview or whatever, if that's what you want. But then if that's what you want, really, is a comedy night the best thing for that anyway? There's probably, you know, novels. There are probably, you know, long reads in The Atlantic or something that'll satisfy that.
So what is it that you are offering as your night when you're on tour? Because your tour shows are... one of the things that interests me about your touring work is that it's very specific in nature. You know, your most recent, your current tour. Are you still on tour at the moment?
Yes, Genius.
Genius. That's about a very specific premise. It's not about, like, my struggles within a particular thing.
No.
It's a broader topic, and before that, I know
it started out for, I mean, Genius is and it continues to evolve, because I'm trying to evolve it and take it back to Edinburgh this August. But it started out really
taking it back.
We'll talk about that
in a minute.
I haven't got a brand new conceit and a new hour to take back, but I think I've got enough working through it. When I started with Genius, I was just interested genuinely in the sort of nature of human intelligence and stuff, and I thought that might be an interesting topic. And it gradually became more of a polemic about, I guess, dumbing down, broadly speaking, you know, and about the collapse of any expectation of intelligence, you know, in public discourse and so on. But what I have found is that when you do, if you're doing an hour long or an hour and a half, you need to have some strong attitude. You need to be talking about something that has just started to irritate you and that you don't feel is being addressed elsewhere. You know, I think if you're just doing a series of, like, amusing anecdotes about things that happened in the car park at the supermarket or whatever, that's great for 20 minutes. But after you get that kind of, so what's your point kind of feeling after a while, you know? And I feel it as well, you know, whereas if I'm kind of, you know, the last one that I did, Leashed, which was essentially about dog ownership, but was really, you know, it was inspired by being sort of forced, basically, by my family to get a dog.
I saw that was at the Stand, was
it?
I remember.
It started at the Stand, that's right, yeah. But it became, you know, a lens through which is just kind of attacking the unnecessary complication of life now. Owning a dog should be, in fact, a very enjoyable and straightforward procedure, and it used to be when I was growing up, and now it's become complicated. And so it was more about sort of middle-class pretension and competitiveness and commodification of things that that don't need commodifying. You know, owning a dog is a straightforward business, but now it's become a very complicated business, and it was like about that really, and about it was about how parenting and rearing children more broadly has become unnecessarily commodified and complicated and
yes,
scientifically, you know, interfered with by experts and so on.
It's aboutness, the extent to which it was about those things.
Yeah.
Whereabouts in the process did that arrive? Was that like, I want to write about this and I'll do it through the medium of dog ownership?
Yeah.
Or were you discovering that it was about that?
I think it's the second. I think
okay.
You start talking about dog ownership and you have a few conversations with your mate and you start laughing about how what idiots we are to have allowed ourselves to get into this, you know, yet another bloody stupid situation. But then it becomes this kind of, you know, a bit of anger flares up as well. And then you think, oh, that's what's really going on there. I mean, it's classic, you know, therapy stuff, isn't it? Not that I've had Freudian therapy, but I've seen it in the movies, so I'm convinced I understand it. But it is essentially somebody goes in thinking that they're angry with their boss and it turns out they're really angry with their mother or whatever. That's usually the, you know, it's like, what's really going on here?
That's
you
an know. Incredible insight. That, absolutely. I experience that in the writing of every show. I
yeah.
start off roughing out, this is, I suppose, what I want to talk about. A lot
yeah.
of that stuff falls away. That's just scaffolding to get the engine started.
Exactly, yeah.
And then I'll go, oh, I'm writing about this, but what is it really about? That's
yeah.
a really interesting way of looking at it, yeah.
And a lot of the time, and with this current show as well, what it's about is... the first Edinburgh show that I took up that had a proper name and any kind of overarching theme at all was called Cycles. That was in 2003. And I didn't really knit the routines together to create a convincing and plausible show that would justify that name. But the idea was that everything moves in cycles. It was the cyclical nature of the universe, whether it be, you know, planets revolving around the sun and seasons revolving and lifetimes revolving and the cyclical nature of the relationships. And everything you go through has this kind of, you know, birth, reproduction and death kind of cycle. And I was just trying to microcosm and macrocosm that, you know, and like explore those ideas. And it is a little bit, as you said earlier, it's quite pretentious. And I don't think I really got it down, but it is something that fascinates me. And I like, you know, spirals in nature and anything that grows like that and rings of trees. They speak to us. They, you know, they satisfy some kind of, I don't know if it's a Jungian kind of notion of an archetype or something, but there's something in us that kind of responds well to things that are cyclical in nature rather than linear. I don't trust linear. I don't believe in linear. This is where my politics come from as much as anything else, because a lot of people, I mean, I think I've started to understand that in myself only quite recently, but the big kind of divide between reactionary and progressive politics is that reactionaries understand that, you know, man is imperfectible and that everything moves in cycles, the cyclical theories of history, you know, the Toynbee and the Spengler and what have you, whereas the progressives believe that man is advancing towards an ultimately perfect state, you know, and that we can continue to perfect things and that we can constantly do better. And so there's that, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that we shouldn't strive for that, but whether you believe that that's going to be the
okay.
destination.
I think I'm broadly across the territory. Toynbee
yeah.
and Spengler, I'm lost at.
Okay, well, Toynbee and Spengler are just a couple of theorists. And they wrote histories of the cycles of civilizations
okay.
and how they're comparable. So the rise and fall of the Roman Empire is a classic example that people now are looking at and going, is America into its final decline? Has it, you know, are the barbarians at the gates kind of thing?
Okay.
But the idea that, you know, on a personal level, you have that. I think that's more, you know, where the stand-up comes in. And, you know, so that you see yourself, I'm now at the stage where my father was at when I was a young boy. And so you just see, and this is how it's changed. And this, for me, is a rich seam in a way that I never felt that. I mean, if you had to pick one absolutely cliched topic that's just been overly explored, an exhausted seam of comedy, it's probably the difference between men and women, right? That's the endless kind of, and sometimes it's down to the difference between cats and dogs or cat people and dog people, but it's always this kind of, you know, this is like this, but this is like this. And in America, it's very much traditionally, it's always been race and ethnicity. So, you know, there's a lot of that old Simpsons thing, like the comedian, the black comedian who says, you know, white people
guys
are
drive like
you
this,
know,
yeah.
black people. Yeah. So you're just comparing two types of things the whole time. But for me, I really find the where I'm at in life and what life was like for my father when he was my age, I find that, you know, the generational gap, you know, and looking back, hasn't, I don't feel, been as exhausted as some other things. And I'm kind of starting to feel that's my territory now. So last show was like, we've got a dog. And when I was a boy, we had a dog, but it's different now in these respects. And this show is about when I was a boy at the age of 9, I got a copy of the Guinness Book of Records. And now my son has a copy of the Guinness Book of Records. But look how the records have changed. Look at where the focus is. Look at what things excite his imagination compared to what used to excite my imagination, or what is presumed to excite the childish imagination now. And that feels to me like it's a fresher, you know, because it has that slightly reactionary assumption in it, which I like, because A, I genuinely like it, and B, it goes against the grain of most comedy, which does definitely tend to be progressive. And
the reactionary assumption to which you're referring there is what exactly?
I suppose it's just that, you know, humans, you know, it's almost like the idea of original sin, you know. It's like we're not, you know, we continually fuck up. It's just that,
yes.
You know, we will just, it will go wrong. And your great, you know, clouds in castles in the sky will crumble and fall. And okay. And these things rise and fall. So it's like the tide, you know. It's just that, it's a vision of the world as being like a tide, whereas I suppose, you know, the liberal view is more you know, tinkering the whole time and thinking that they can improve things, you know, whereas there's a certain kind of, I'm not religious, I'm not, but it's a kind of Catholic, I think, you know, a traditional Catholic kind of worldview, which I do find more plausible, more convincing, you know, I think, than there's obviously progress in terms of science and knowledge and understanding. In some senses, we have a far greater understanding of genetics, for instance, than we did. I mean, you could say 100 years ago, it was understood as a mechanism, you know, but how it might actually work, nobody had any idea. And certainly 200 or 300 years ago, no idea at all. But then again, you only have to read Plato and Aristotle to see that 2,500 years ago, there were men who had a better grasp of how society functions and how it falls and how it fails than most people do now. So do you see what I mean?
Yes, I think so. Okay.
So I'm just saying, the compare and the contrast thing between different generations and different cycles of life is a more interesting seam. And when I say seam, it's not like a random term. I mean, people say about the seam of comedy, but a seam of coal is created by two, you know, huge geological lumps of you know, squeezing some organic matter and grinding it, you know, and that is the seam that between the two contrasting
men and women, men on one side and women on the other,
wherever there is comparison between a dynamic
applying pressure to itself. Okay.
Yeah. So that's one that interests me now, generational change, how things are changing. And I think it's enough, there's almost enough there for a lifetime, really. It's just a question of what you put under that particular lens. But that interests me more than, I never quite believe it when, I mean, funnily enough, although I argue in favour of, you know, a certain amount of realism about sex differences between men and women, for instance, which is on Twitter, is like incredibly controversial. I don't know how controversial it is in real life, but, you know, people get sacked for writing memos saying that maybe guys are just more into coding than women are. I think most people in normal life probably just shrug and go, maybe they are. Yeah, probably they are. I don't know. But it's incredibly, you know, politically hot in certain circles. But I'm not that interested in it as a comedy trope. I've never been that bothered about. I think my wife is quite masculine in certain stereotypical ways, and I'm quite feminine. So maybe that's why. I don't know. She's certainly more organised than me. She's very solution orientated. If anyone comes to her with their problems, she won't just listen and nod sympathetically. She will start to suggest to them a route out, which can be really annoying.
Yeah,
to
I was going
to
say.
You know, people hate that.
Really annoy my wife by suggesting routes out of things.
This is supposed to be why men are rubbish at being empathic listeners, and why they're rubbish at being, you know, mates. And the women go, no, you don't understand, just listen. Well, my wife is, well, I'm quite happy to just sit there and listen, or at least to sort of, you know, reflect and share and, you know.
And is this, it feels like the recognition of that territory as being yours to win.
Yeah.
Is quite an important area of the last 5 years of your career.
Yes, and again, it's not a thing that I would, I didn't map it out at all, but I can see that it has become the thing that I've done in the last three shows, because the previous one to Least, which was called Friendly Fire, which was just a silly sort of punning title, It came from a tweet that I'd done over. I went to see a movie called Friendly Fire. It killed a couple of hours. And it was just a silly pun. And then I just thought I'd make that the title of this show. But it turned out to be about the difference in what were male role models between when I was growing up and my son growing up. So looking at footballers now, who my own son, as soon as he learned that John Terry had cheated with his teammate's wife, he absolutely hates John Terry now with an extraordinary moral indignation he has. And I don't think enough people acknowledge that boys have that kind of sense of, and I'm sure girls do too, have that sense of moral indignation about people when they know they've behaved badly, but they're, I don't know, it's put up as a sort of parade. And anyway, I talked about sort of old-fashioned boys' own heroes, and I focused in on Ernest Shackleton, you know, the polar explorer, and told a story, and it ended with this kind of five-minute tableau of Shackleton's miraculous escape, you know, with all his men's lives from the jaws of death in the Antarctic in 1914, or 1916 by the time they got back, and drew that contrast. And so that was probably the first time that I'd done that. You know, these are what used to pass for heroes then, and this is how you achieve some kind of heroic fame now. This is how you get onto bedroom walls now. And it's just, I think that's become a thing that I just, yeah, I've sort of become aware that that's my... And it's something that's quite... It's not unique to me, but it certainly doesn't feel like it's something that's, you know, overly... It's yes. not endlessly paddled one way or another. You know, you can... You can go to a lot of comedy nights now and see this, you know, this. If you can go with some great material, but if somebody has already been in that area, you know, there's no getting around it. You know, the audience went, this again, you know.
Yeah. I'm just on a side note about Shackleton. I have only just learnt the story of Shackleton literally last week because I have been lazily using him as an example of an Antarctic explorer for a bit that I've got in a new show that I'm writing for Edinburgh this year. So I was like, and in fact, to my shame, I thought... I'd better learn more about him because it might be an opportunity for more gags. And then I learned, and I couldn't believe the end of the story that everybody lived. It's the most incredible thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's astonishing.
Huge. His the boat trip from Elephant Island to South Georgia and then crossing South Georgia on foot with no map, never been surveyed, the whole interior of that island. A complete wilderness, unknown, never crossed and unmapped and up to, I think, 12,000 feet, some of the mountain ranges.
I'm sure he's thrilled to be remembered as a footnote in a bunch of comedians doing jokes about other things.
Something, I then went on, I did him as my specialist subject on Celebrity Mastermind as
Yeah.
So he became a bit of a speciality for me for a while, but, you know, eventually you've got to move on. I have to sort of almost remind myself of this sometimes because I find myself buying books and thinking, oh, I'm interested in that, aren't I? I'm not actually as interested in the things that men were interested in 30 years ago, I'm as much as I'm interested in what those things were as a sort of sociological conversation about we used to be as men interested in this and now it turns out we're less so, or are we all just still interested in those things? But, you know, I mean, a lot of people are still obsessed with the Second World War. That's still a huge publishing topic. You know, the number of books still released annually about Hitler and about the Third Reich and about, you know, specific battles and specific invasions and what have you, you know, and operations is extraordinary. I mean, that's, you know, it's... And I'm not that interested in it, but I sort of tried to get interested in it in a way to try and understand what the interest was, but I don't get it.
is that kind of... reflective of the kind of the difference between the dynamic between your onstage persona and your actual persona in that you're this territory of being a slightly fusty or professorial or maybe kind of, you know, you look like a sort of you've got military bearing, the clicked tones,
prep school headmaster, people have said
absolutely
sort of thing,
you know. Disdainful you know what I mean, but and in a very funny
try
way
and grasp this minor.
You absolutely should
three battalions on the eastern flank, how many will it take to surround and perform a pincer movement, come on, we've been through this, you know.
I've just thought, I don't know if you've ever done this, but I think it would be hilarious if you were to ask people their names and only ever mean their surnames.
That's very good. No, I never have done that. Yeah, very good.
But So that, which we know isn't you, when you...
I'm more interested in the sociology or the evolutionary psychology or whatever you want to call it, of the things that people are interested in.
Yes.
Than the things that they're interested
yes,
in.
Understood. Yes, understood. Absolutely.
But, of course, then you have conversations. And, I mean, I can talk to somebody like Al Murray, for instance, who you may have done on this show, who is very good on history, really, really strong on 20th century and German history in particular, is the complete opposite of his pub landlord persona in that respect, and he's really well versed on the war. And I have conversations with him in which he has really genuinely interesting insights into how the war was conducted or into why a certain general was removed from a certain campaign because, you know. And I think, oh, God, it is interesting. Those people are right because, you know, but that's because you're having a conversation about it and it becomes fascinating. And then you see the thickness of the book you need to read in order to get that one interesting, you know, and you think, no.
I may as well just have a conversation with a learned friend.
Yes. Yeah.
So this is Simon, and as you can hear, if you download the extras of this show, which are available at comedianscomedian.com/insiders for people who want to support the show with a recurring monthly donation and receive not just extras, but a whole host of other projects that you have access to, a workspace where you and other insiders and myself can talk about strategy, and we can talk about anything. We can talk about writing. There are various other podcast projects where we can critique other comedians' work, newer acts when they send their work in, and all sorts of stuff. And that's all bubbling away and growing and developing itself and being developed by the community as we speak. Not only that, not only all of those content, but specifically with Simon's extras, we go a bit more into detail on Simon's recent Question Time appearance. We talk about the surprise in store for anyone meeting Simon's parents. And we have a really good chat about social marketing and some of the options available to an act of Simon's seniority. People for whom a sudden pivot into social media represents a certain credibility risk, shall we say. There's some fascinating thoughts there. So go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders and you can download the extras from this show, as well as extras from Sophie Willen, Anuvab Pal, Dara O'Brien, James Acaster, Sarah Millican, and all of the other extras that have ever been available from this show. Sign up for £2 a month or more. You can do £3 a month. I think the options are £3, £5, £7.50 and £10, as well as £2. I am currently honouring everyone who started off the few £1 a month people from the last few years. Everyone currently has access at that rate, but that's no longer available to incoming new people. But regardless of how much you pay, you get access to the same amount of content. So please take a look at that, comedianscomedian.com/insiders. It can also be accessed via cashforgoldsmith.com. And that is a real true thing, thanks to listener Laura Serbin, who came up with that very amusing web address. I'd like to thank everyone at Angel Comedy at the Bill Murray Pub, thank you very much for the recording space for this show and many like it. There's a lot more coming up then. I'm always worried that I'll forget to thank people. But you, as if you're a comedian or if you're an audience member, you can take huge advantage of everything that's going on at the Bill Murray Pub. It's in Angel, and it is part of it's the property leased by Angel Comedy. Four comics got together and bought the lease on a pub for God knows how long, 20 years or so, to try and make it a going concern, which has shows every night, sometimes numerous shows every night, and also during the day is a resource for comedians. And Barry Ferns, who is one of the people associated with it, he in particular has such an excitement and a vision for what is possible with a community and an organisation like that. He's the sort of person that if you've got a crazy idea for a comedy-related project, definitely talk to Barry and the team at Angel Comedy based at the Bill Murray Pub, because they are really excited about being excited about things. They're really excited about projects and developing things. So I would highly recommend you seek them out if you have a night that you want to run, an experiment that you want to try, some sort of benevolent mental health project for comedians, space you need during the day to record things in, all sorts of things like that. Go and check out. And let's not forget, brilliant shows every night, sometimes for free and often for very little money. That's enough of a shout out for them, I think, but they've been very good to me recently, so I think they deserve every word of that. Now, let's get back to Simon Evans.
My career in comedy really started as a heckler. You know, I used to like sitting in comedy clubs and just, you know, just, but not like bollocks, get off, you know, like slight, you know, if I didn't, if somebody's routine seemed to me, as was quite common, I wouldn't do it unnecessarily and just, you know, on two or three occasions.
Where is this? Whereabouts? Which club is this?
Well, the first one I remember was, I'll tell you this story. This was at the Comedy Store when it was still on Leicester Square, where the 99 Club took up and I think has moved on from now. Yes. But anyway, it was in a basement. It was quite a small club by the standards of the modern Comedy Store. Arthur Smith was comparing, and he did a couple of jokes before he brought on the first act, of course. And one of them was about the fire regulations, and there was something about there's a fire extinguisher at the back if there are any students in, I wanted to play a prank, which, funnily enough, was the specific crime committed by my friends that I mentioned earlier. But anyway, nicking a fire extinguisher. But if there's a fire extinguisher at the back, if there's any students in, ha ha ha. And then during the course of his opening sort of 10 minutes or whatever, he told a joke about a peanut. I can't remember what the joke was, but the...
entered a marathon the other day. Chocolate and peanuts all over me knob? No?
It wasn't that one, although that is one of his, isn't it? But I can't remember what it was. But I think it was about a woman choking on a peanut or something like that, but I can't remember why. Anyway, so it had a peanut in it. Brings on the first interval, whatever, second section, and brings on a couple of open spots. And one of them was, he was dying on his arse. And
you
I realized
heckled an open spot, Simon. This is like finding out you used to be a critic.
But I was young and I wasn't in the industry or anything at this point. But he wasn't just dying. He was really annoying. He was kind of arrogant. He seemed to have no humility or recognition that.
Open spots.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, I had no sympathy for him. The audience were like, oh, God, make this end. And he made exactly the same joke about the fire extinguisher at the back of the room that Arthur had earlier. So not only was he not funny, but he hadn't bothered to show up in time to watch the, instinctively I understood was not on. And so the room just went silent as he did this fire extinguisher joke. And I shouted out, do the peanut joke. And I got easily the biggest laugh of the piss set. You know, I think there was a smattering of applause. And he, of course, didn't have any idea what I was talking about because he hadn't bothered to show up early enough to see.
Oh, my God.
So it was a double whammy from his point of view. It wasn't merely heckled. He was like a complete ninja attack.
The top of this anecdote is going to be if you now tell us that he grew up to become a famous television comedian.
I don't think he was ever seen again.
Maybe as a frustrated comic, is listening to this. Do you have anything to say to him?
I did you a favour. And I hope you learned your lesson. I always regarded it as important if you were doing an open spot to be there from the start. I don't
100%.
Know. 9 times out of 10, you don't hear anything significant, but you get a sense of what's going on.
Absolutely
in the room,
right.
You know,
absolutely right. But this, as an origin story, a superhero origin story, which I'm fond of attributing, the former heckler. I mean, you got from the safest place possible, you were able to experience the enormous rush of an audience laughing at your thing. I mean, what an origin. How many days were there between that and you signing up?
No,
for
quite
overnight?
A long time. I think probably another 5 years passed before I started doing comedy. And I actually started
5 years
doing
of heckling?
It through improv, which I did for a couple of years before I did stand-up as well. But I did always remember it. I remember that rush and I remember that feeling of wanting to get back to it. But I mean, anyone does it in a pub, don't they, with the... But I suppose the distinction I'm making in terms of social gatherings, let's say there's five or six mates in a pub having a beer, some of them will hold court, have a beer, and everyone is listening to them and they're telling a story about, you know, what happened at the match or whatever that's hilarious. I was never that guy. I could not hold court. I could never hold focus. I could never string like an anecdote together and make everyone buy into my kind of characterization of what was going on. But what I could do if somebody was being a bit boring with their anecdote was I would be the one to cut the tension. I could be the one who would just put in the single stroke, you know, the single sword and slice it down. And that would be the end of it. And it would get a big laugh. And it was, you know, it was always undercutting pretension. It was always undercutting pomposity or whatever, that I could do that. But as soon as I tried to then take, okay, I've sliced this guy down, I now climb onto, you know, and I could never hold it at all. Nobody would even have to, like, under, you know, slice me. So that's quite an odd, I don't know if that's a common thing, but that's quite an odd thing to then think, right, I will now do 20 minutes of that, because, you know, who are you going to be assassinating? So you have to sort of create a dynamic where you are you know, cutting yourself down, you know. So there's this kind of, you have to do this kind of, I am not quite aware of the degree to which I am a pompous buffoon myself, you know, in order that I can then reveal that to be the case with, you know, asides or whatever.
What was the first joke where you felt, the first joke you'd written where you felt, I have achieved exactly what you're talking about there? That thing of establishing who you are for the audience by undercutting your own pomposity.
Well, there was one, I mean, it's a bit obvious from the construction of it, really, but there was one quite early on where I said, I was going through some paperwork the other day and I found a letter from an old girlfriend. It said, "Dear Simon, I'm leaving you, you anally retentive asshole." And to me, that was funny already, because the fact that somebody keeps that sort of letter means they're anally retentive. But the audience never laughed at that point. I don't know how many people even... I mean, anally retentive is one of those... It was quite a common term 20 years ago. And thinking about it, I don't think you hear it that much now.
Well, I think people hang on.
It's one of those vaguely sort of Freudian terms. Anyway, anally retentive arsehole. And then I developed it a bit further to kind of hammer home the point. It was like... And I had to laugh because, for a start, she'd failed to hyphenate anally retentive. I had to date it for her myself, filed it under R for rejection, correspondence files, brackets, romance. And it would just all went down that, sure. You know, it just be elaborated it until they kind of go, oh, that's what anally retentive means.
Yes.
I think a lot of people, you know, needed that little bit of nudging. But it was probably the first fully... I don't know, what do you call that? Like, is that dramatic irony or something? That kind of, you know, where you're apparently not aware of
you're simultaneously, yeah. You're satisfied in your own idiocy.
Yes, exactly.
Like, you're not undercutting yourself in I'm an idiot. You're blissfully unaware that you're...
Yeah, yeah, exactly, you know. And then this, as I say, brazen disregard for other people's sort of sensibilities or feelings, or, you know, so that goes into that whole Geordie thing where, you know, it's not about criticising them or disparaging them. It's more about being adopting the tone of a sort of genial Victorian anthropologist, you know, who's going, remarkable people, they feel no need, they don't feel the cold at all, you know, and all that sort of thing. It's that kind of approach rather than anything more aggressive towards them, you know, and then you can have you can have your cake and eat it in that respect. You know?
Yes. Yes, I'm so delighted by that. I've forgotten to rack up another question. that is genuinely fascinating to come to have the crucible in which you were kind of forged initially as a comic to be sniping.
Yeah,
like, I mean, that's...
I see myself as a sniper, and I still think of that. And you know, if I'm in a room with other comedians, I'm very rarely like the funny one again holding court, or whatever. I'm much funnier if I'm in a room with three or four other people who are not particularly funny. You know, that's where I find, okay, I will step up. If I'm in a room with three or five other comedians, I won't try to be funny at all. I won't even chuck stuff in there.
Sure.
You know, I don't know, maybe it's not very generous of me, but I'm much more likely to go, somebody will crack a joke and everyone will laugh, and I'm more likely to be the one going, yeah, I'm not sure that's quite fair though, is it? Because you think, but you want to be, and I can't say, it's just a joke. I mean, you do not understand.
And does that then, is that reflected in your not... what's the opposite of a predisposition for panel games? You're saying you haven't ever felt that you've been as good on a panel game as you are on your own.
Yeah.
Because some comics love to be standing around in a circle slamming each other.
Yeah, yeah.
And some comics that isn't.
I mean, I think partly it helps to have a bit of practice, doesn't it, with panel games, to play the same one two or three times. And I'm not saying it wouldn't work. I think for some reason I never did quite get them. Mock the Week was a long story, and that was obviously one that broke for a lot of people. I was on the run-throughs for that a couple of times, and it didn't quite work for me there. And so I think they felt they tried me out and it hadn't worked. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
It was kind of, I was really excited about it initially. It was, oh my God, I'm in at the ground floor. But in fact, the whole game, the setup, how it works and everything, I hadn't quite grasped it. I hadn't seen how it would go, you know. Anyway, that's by the by. But it is a little bit tricky if you are, if you are more of a sniper, you know. And you're not allowed to develop a persona, you know, in the space of 30 seconds, which allows the audience to understand the ironic sort of detachment about what you're doing.
Yeah. Yes, and it's almost now that there is a marketing angle that you can employ of being, if not the Brexit comedian, then at least a non-wishy-washy liberal comedian.
Yeah, right.
That's an angle, it's marketable.
Yeah.
But also following that line marketing-wise doesn't allow for the sort of richness of your actual opinion. Like, you're not going, you're not Jeff Norcott. You're not playing the note of, I'm the only conservative comedian in the country.
Yes.
You know, and that would kind of limit the scope, perhaps, of what you do.
Yes.
But also, you might find yourself getting booked for those kind of gigs because...
Yeah, yeah. It's
true. I mean, are you turning down lots of corporates from the EDL?
I'm not sure the EDL has the sort of money I'd like. Judging by the uniforms, I think. No, it's interesting that I have watched Jeff. It has been interesting watching.
And
Jeff,
I don't. I don't mean to knock Jeff at all. No, I think he's an excellent comic,
but he has got a very different approach to the whole issue than I have. Which is, you know, I mean, I think he gets away with quite a lot of. Yeah, he can knock Corbyn, of course. Almost anyone can, but he has that sort of council estate Tory. You know, he is like what was it called? Not Braintree. What was the place in Essex where the man, you know, like Mondeo man was supposed to come from, and he sort of created Thatcher's, you know. So it's that it is very different to my sort of patrician. Ah, you fools, you don't quite, you know, you have not seen, have you, how this, you know.
Note to self, refer to Simon as the patrician in the show notes.
But that is, I mean, that is, you know, in terms of the persona, but also the interest, it is that kind of wanting to float above it, like a sort of Ralph Richardson sort of character, you know, just in Time Bandits, you know, that sort of, a bit of local difficulty sort of thing, you know.
Yes.
That's always amused me. That kind of, I mean, I find those people, you know, and they're a dying breed, obviously probably a dead breed, but the, you know, they cropped up in British films, Jack Hawkins sort of characters, you know, a regimental tie, but but not bloodthirsty and not you know, not hugely ambitious, not, you know, every bit as much sympathy for the common man, the working man, as they had for the aristocracy or whatever. That not a kind of not a sort of spiteful, mean, you know, against greed, against commercialism. You know, there's a TV drama series I'm watching at the moment, which is, I think it came out a few years ago. Benedict Cumberbatch plays an aristocrat in the dawn of the First World War who is disappointed that, you know, the way the country is going just generally and the drift. But he sees the war. They're based on Ford Madox Ford books, which I haven't read, but which are, you know, considered to be proper literature. And the thing was scripted by Tom Stoppard, so it's a proper kind of piece of work, but it's similar to sort of themes to Downton Abbey, I suppose, the sort of end of the Edwardian summer and the collapse of that apparently idyllic setup. But it's his sense that conservatism means duty, you know, duty to those below as well as to those above, you know, a sense of stewardship, a sense of responsibility for maintenance of a bequest, you know, which is the country, and as he says, the agrarian is against the industrial, which was the great strife, you know, in the fight for the soul for America as well, which has now been conclusively lost, and that's kind of, you know, not necessarily that I have that, but that's that's the kind of person who I feel I want to sort of speak on behalf of, you know, rather than Mondeo man, you know, which is where I think Jeff's coming from, which is equally valid and funny and has loads of great jokes as well, but that's quite a different thing.
That's interesting, your description there of conservatism, or that's the most attractive portrait of the word conservatism heard.
Well, it's why there is no, as Peter Hitchens, you know, correctly says, there is no conservative party anymore now. There are two approaches to the same mercantilist, you know, race to the bottom. It's, I mean, Roger Scruton would probably be the most highest esteemed thinker in these terms now, but Hitchens is a slightly more populist voice for it, but still characterises it pretty well. You know, you probably have to embrace Anglicanism at the very least as well, which I don't. I find it fascinating and sad and melancholy, but it's, you know, it's gone. But that's where the voice comes from, I think.
I seem to remember you being careful in the past never to explicitly confirm your political leanings.
Yeah.
Is that still something that you...
I have no real political leanings. I mean, I've never felt... I don't think in my adult lifetime I've ever voted with conviction for anyone. I have voted, but never with conviction, never with confidence, never with hope in my heart that this party would win and that would lose. I think, funnily enough, probably of all the leaders I've known in my lifetime, John Major was the closest to somebody who I felt really was a good man and doing his best to do the right thing for the country. I certainly didn't feel the enthusiasm everybody else did for Tony Blair when he arrived, and I feel I've been vindicated in that view.
Well, there is that.
I think every John clown. Major, and secondly, I would think Gordon Brown. Those have probably been the two leaders. Again, both... Yes. Probably the two who were most disparaged and experienced the most contempt generally from the press and from...
And what is it you saw in those two, obviously leaders from two different parties? Is it sort of like ignoring the kind of partisan? Is it a sense of decency?
Well, it was the fact that they did ignore the partisan to some extent. You know, they both had a view of Britain. And of course, I'm not deluded. Gordon Brown was quite sincerely socialist in his outlook. And if he'd had a free rein, he would, I think, probably have changed the economic profile of Britain quite a bit, you know, if he hadn't encountered the biggest, financial catastrophe of the post-war era almost as soon as he sort of, you know, got his legs under the desk. But I think they were broadly quite pragmatic, phlegmatic and decent, yeah. Just that, really. And we're operating from certain principles. One has to have certain principles, but I don't think that they were... There was nothing messianic about them, you know.
In terms of the audience who come to see you when you're touring and the audience that you are cultivating, it seemed to me like the decision to go on Question Time was... Kind of was that sort of part of?
I think what I was enjoying was the sequence of events. If just to explain, I wasn't pressing for that, but I was on the news quiz one evening, and everybody, as usual, was just slamming into Trump. Oh, Trump is a catastrophe. Trump is the worst thing to ever happen to Britain. Trump will lead us into war. And then Miles came to me, and I just felt like sort of I was a slight devilment, really, but I just said that. You know, whilst he is unquestionably, you know, on aesthetic grounds, you know, there's something quite unpleasantly vulgar about him. The reality is the American economy has never been stronger, despite the likes of Paul Krugman saying that America would be bankrupt within 12 months of a Trump administration. It has, in fact, it has grown in all important metrics. The stock market has reached record highs
because
on an almost
kind of,
weekly basis.
Because of the confidence that Trump brings to it.
There's less people in him. There's less unemployment. There's more less black and Latino unemployment, for people who say that he is, implicitly racist in his policies. There have been all kinds of positive outcomes. Syria is in a better place than it was throughout most of Obama's reign. And we have a situation now in Korea where, they had just opened lines. Of course, that's faltering. Of course it will. But, the idea that he has brought this catastrophe upon the world, in reality, what he's brought is a hideous mess for anyone who bothers to read on a daily basis about Washington, the wasp's nest of Washington, which, to be honest, if it's not my business, this endless Russia probe bollocks has just been going on forever and nobody's getting anywhere with it. It's just nonsense as far as I can see. So anyway, I said this, objectively speaking, he's probably the most successful president of my lifetime. And within a year of taking office, George W. Bush had plunged the world into war, Within a year of coming into office, Obama had trebled the national, deficit. I mean, there are all these, he hasn't actually done anything bad. I'm not saying it's his fault or it's not his fault. I'm just saying the first year has been fairly quiet, except for the endless, snarking. Anyway, off the back of that, I was invited to appear on a thing called The Big Questions, which is Nikki Campbell's Sunday morning debate programme. And they were talking about Trump's first year, and so I went on that, and I enjoyed it. And there was quite a lot of cut and thrust there, and you talk over each other and you row. It's 10 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday. You've had to have lots of coffee to wake up, and then you've overdone it, of course. So everyone's a bit kind of, And I really enjoyed that. And they also make Question Time, so they rang me up and went, oh, we thought you were great. Would you like to come on Question Time? So then, of course, there's that kind of, is it just an ego thing? Will it actually help my career? It's almost certainly more likely to do more damage than good. There almost certainly will have been somebody, for instance, a corporate booker, who saw me on Question Time and just went, oh, it's a bit controversial. Some of our members might not like his line on Brexit or indeed, on Windrush or something, and you just don't know what you try and be reasonable, but there will always be people who go, well, I don't think that's right. And then, of course, much better to keep shtum, really. in terms of your career. But at the same time, you just sort of think, I'd quite like to have a go at that, you know.
Yes.
Sure, 12-year-old Simon sitting in front of the telly watching Robin Day would have thought, wow, one day I could actually be out there.
Yes.
Let's go, oh, God, yes, let's just do it. But it is, you know, it is the temptation of the ego more than anything else. But it's not at all strategic. The reality is, you shouldn't do these things, really, unless you really have something you want to say. My wife works in PR. She knows this. She's always saying to me, think to yourself, what is it you're trying to achieve? Will this help me achieve it? The answer is 9 times out of 10, no, it won't. You know, yes, just too easily distracted and... You
well,
know,
it's interesting that you say that initial Trump kind of outburst of yours on the Now Show was, yeah, the news quiz, sorry, was in a spirit of devilment.
Yeah.
And then you clearly warmed to the topic. Like, in your description there, you kind of go, this is devilment. And then you give, like,
yeah,
8 good, well-researched
but it's
reasons.
Devilment.
Very easy for me to listen to that and think, well, that's not devilment. That's just, yeah, actually what you think.
It's only devilment to say that he's the greatest president of our lifetime.
I understand.
I think in reality, what it's illustrated is that, you know, the world is a very, very complex, slow moving,
sure,
you know, it's an oil tanker, isn't it? You know, and no, whoever's the captain of an oil tanker, it can take decades before the effects of their actions, you know, become apparent. You know, a slight deviation in course, you know,
sure.
But it was just this kind of pretense that the world is in flames because of Trump. Trump is a symptom of the fact that the world is in flames and has been for some time. That's
absolutely
my view.
Well, that I totally agree with that. I think, yeah, that is a very reasonable,
yeah,
view, which is kind of like, not equivocation, but is like, let's all think about this. It's all actually more complex than a,
yeah,
soundbite.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet, I wonder if in saying that, in bothering to say that, and for the devilment element of it,
yeah,
you then become one of the very few people who has an apparently, yes, Trump voice. You then benefit from that. You,
yeah,
then,
yeah,
attract an audience who maybe think, oh, well, this is where this guy's coming,
that's
from.
That's the thing.
Who
you,
then you...
You can do that.
Disappoint,
of
perhaps,
course. You can. Well, exactly. And there is that danger, because you can go full, you know, Andrew Lawrence or whatever, and just go, I am the non-PC comedian. And if you're tired of PC, come and see me, because I will crack jokes about Islam every bit with as much as I will about Christianity or anybody else, you know. Not that I'm a bigot, but just that I am not going to tiptoe around subjects that other comedians deem to be untouchable. And that isn't, you know, who I want to be, you know. So in that respect, unless you're going to capitalise on it, it probably doesn't help to be this guy who's kind of, as you say, if you can chuck a brick through the window, but unless you're going to then reach through that window and, you know, open the door and enter the premises, what have you really achieved? You know, not very much necessarily. But it is, yeah, it's just that wanting constantly to destabilise things. I think as much as anything else, it's almost wanting to break the skin on the can of, on the top of the paint, do you know what I mean? And not just sort of see that this is settled. Just go, well, no, it's not settled. I don't know that I do accept that Trump is a disaster. And by saying, of course, he's the greatest president of our lifetime,
yes,
I've lit fireworks instead of just, but, you know, the extent to which you then double down on that and try and prove that your foolish assertion, you know, bears weight is, that's tactics, isn't it? But, you know, you've at least stirred trouble, you know, and I think that is, it is, a lot of it is just, yeah, it's just that, it's just like wanting to see the wasp's nest and just go, you know. But I
poke
just
it with your field marshal's
exactly,
baton.
Yes. The endless self-satisfied, you know, and self... I don't know exactly how to put this, but the, you know, the liberal consensus, which just grows ever and ever more sure and convinced of itself. And everyone does it on both sides. There's no two... In terms of the material that I read and see anyway, you know, and on Twitter, if you spend much time on Twitter, you become convinced that 99% of the tweets are like generated by computers now. They just repeat the same, on both sides, they just repeat the same observations. And everyone is accused of not being capable of critical thinking, and everyone is accused of being low IQ, and everyone is accused of being a bot, which is what that means, you know. Just,
yes.
And you just think, this is just insane, you know, but...
It's this weird kind of, it recalls kind of a Prince Charles's fear about grey nanobot suit, doesn't it? Whereby the discourse itself just becomes auto-generated, what can you trust? And even were it not for actual bots, the fact of the same, you're a straw man. No, you're a straw.
Yeah,
pretty much
yeah.
as soon as anyone employs
Absolutely.
One of the tactics of naming the type
yes,
of argument
yes.
someone else is doing,
yes,
I turn
exactly.
the computer off. I walk away because
everyone
what's the point
very
anymore?
Quickly goes to that point of kind of going, oh, liberal tears or, you know, white
sure.
man's tears. You know, we register that you're upset about this, but your facts don't care about your feelings. That comes in from both sides. You know?
Yes, exactly.
You're afraid of science. You're afraid of facts. These are just, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, both sides do.
Sorry that this has hurt you so much. You
know? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, God, where is that going? Where do you foresee any of that going?
Well, I don't know. I am obviously in favour of free speech, but then when you see how most people use it, you think it's not that, you know, but it's the trouble with it is, just on a personal level, for me, it is quite addictive because it is an easy way to avoid getting on with the work you're supposed to be doing, which tends to be quite, you know, it's grindingly difficult by comparison, you know, trying to create stand-up. It's very, good stand-up is very pithy, isn't it? It's reduced, it's like granite. Ideally, it should be like diamonds, you know, whereas on Twitter, you can just keep, you know, you're just skimming stones, aren't you? And it's rewarding. Somebody comes back at you, you know, you have a chat, and it's very addictive kind of form of discourse that feels like you're thinking about things and creating material, but you're not. You're not. You come away with nothing that you can use. You
know? Yes. Well, let's talk about the grinding process, the granite.
Okay.
Let's talk about that. I mean, go on. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The type of... I often use you as an example of a particular type of comedy whereby your lines are diamond hard.
Yeah.
And although they're not necessarily lines, you're not a one-liner comic... You're not a rambling anecdotalist, you know. If you're telling a story, it's because there is a diamond hard punchline at the end of it, and probably several throughout it as well.
I hope
how
so.
How can you teach other people to do that?
I think it's tricky because I did think my club set used to be, you know, trimmed of fat successfully. It took years, you know. It was doing it live and just noticing when a line which didn't get a laugh and didn't seem to contribute to the tension in the build-up or anything could just be removed, and you understood that. And then the extra lines, the sort of throwaways or the toppers or whatever, would occur to you whilst you were on stage. You know, that is the best place to write. There's no doubt about that at all in my mind. Most of the good stuff occurs to you. So you have to have enough to get up on stage with, and then you're just constantly... You know, I think of it sometimes as being like that thing where you fling pizza bases into the air, you know, and as they spin and they just open out a little bit, and that's how you have to keep throwing it up, you know, and just work it on stage. Very hard to write all that from scratch, you know, at a word processor. I mean, the initial writing is usually, I think, done with... I've got a couple of ideas. I've either... sometimes... try and introduce them into conversation in the pub without people realising that's what I'm doing. But sometimes I just get I have a couple of sort of writing partners who I pay them to come over, but I will try and make it as informal as possible. I don't like those kind of we're going to write some jokes kind of sessions. It's just like, can I ask you to, you know, come for a walk with me and we'll just talk this through this stuff, you know.
Almost to try and... Did you say to pay those people? Like on a
paid
basis?
I do pay them because I think it's... sometimes they do, you know, contribute lines that I use, you know, entirely. And one or two of them are comedians themselves. But generally speaking, I try and avoid using comedians if I can, because I just want there to be sort of funny conversation, you know. Somehow you've got to suspend disbelief that you're not doing this for any reason other than that it's amusing you, you know.
That's really interesting. That is something I've considered trying to do. There are certain friends I have with whom I seem to always be funny.
Yeah.
There's just something, I am funnier.
Yeah.
And I suppose if I was paying them, then I'd feel less guilty about whipping my phone out and going, I'm terribly sorry, I am going to write that down.
Yeah, exactly. It's a tricky one, though, because, I mean, you know, it doesn't exactly ruin the friendship, but it can put them slightly on their guard, or they suddenly feel like, am I delivering? You know, it's a weird...
Yeah.
It's very hard.
Are there any ways to get round that? I can see how that must be difficult.
No, I mean, you can either... It depends whether they're earning a good living anyway and whether they just don't mind, you know. So anyone who's got a good career on the go, you know, I will sort of say, you know, can we just go out and have a beer? And, and they'll go, yeah, oh, that's a good idea. I'll tell you what I think about that, you know.
Sure.
And they go, oh, that's very good. That is interesting, you know. But I think finally, when it has to be honed down to finding the exact right expression, the exact right word for it, you know, that has to happen on stage, really. I think you have to say things a few times. And it happens fairly quickly, you know. I mean, from the very first preview I did for the current show, Genius, was an absolute disaster. I mean, it was just, you know, it was awkward. There were long silences, you know, routines would end without the audience having really connected with it at any point.
And what kind of a...
And by 20 sort of previews, I guess, or something like that, by the time it got onto stage, you know, it was good. And then by the end of the Edinburgh run, it was very good, you know.
And that first preview, how many people are in the audience for that? What kind of environment are you doing?
30, that was in a... It was an upstairs room in a pub in Kingston, I think.
Okay. And had you written sort of a draft of the show?
I'd written bullet points, but I tried to kind of, you know, yeah, I tried to extrapolate them. The routines weren't word for word in my head by any means. So you had
bullet points and you're walking on thinking, I've got something to say about Alan Turing. Yeah. For example, so if we take that Turing example, the premise there, the very funny premise is that he was punished for his sexuality, whereas these days he'd be punished for his intelligence.
People would roll their eyes a little bit. Endless fucking hell. Maths again.
So how much...
Right,
so
shove it down our throats.
The bullet point would be Turing and then... that kind of foundational premise.
Yeah.
That's the funny thing I've got to say about this. And then you just talk around it and try and say that bit.
And then
last.
You hear yourself saying, and if you nail a sort of formal words right, you sort of know it, even though they haven't laughed this time, you know that next time you'll be able to deliver that with the confidence that it will work, you know. But I do think finding just the right word is the key. It's, you know, I think about Stephen Fry's book, I think it was The Hippopotamus, where's the one about it, there's a poet who's in it, it's a novel, I can't remember very much about the plot, but I remember at one point, there's this sort of old poetry don, you know, at Oxford or something, and he says, people are always saying to me, oh, I had a marvellous idea for a poem the other day, and I always say, well, that's a shame, isn't it, because poems aren't made of ideas, they're made of words.
Mm.
And I think that's really insightful, you know. It's obviously, you know, if there are no... but words carry, you know, ideas with them, but the specifics of the word... This is why I find it very difficult to do my comedy anyway. I don't think it travels particularly well. It plays well to expats, who are actually quite nostalgic for Englishness, but it doesn't really play well to American audiences so well, or because the word comes freighted with all sorts of little associations, you know, and the specific... And I think it's not like... This is not to say that it's verbose at all. In fact, the opposite. I think some of the great writers were... now their names have just suddenly gone... the Steptoe guys. What were they called?
They're all double acts in those days, weren't they? Galton and Simpson and...
Galton and Simpson. So their writing, very, very Anglo-Saxon, very monosyllabic, but just brilliantly, perfectly... chose sometimes the understatement of it. There's a lovely line about in Hancock, I used to think my mum's cooking was bad, but at least her gravy used to move about a bit. And it's a bit, you know, a lot of comedians would be tempted to say, at least her gravy was vaguely mobile or was, you know...
Yes.
But it move about a bit. It's got that sort of... I don't know, it's like a... It's so native, you know what I mean?
Yes.
It's like there's army humour or market trader or something, you know, it has... There's so little... And that's... the highfalutin stuff sets up the joke, but actually it's that word,
yes.
You know, it's that simple Anglo... Alan Corran was a genius at that, and he was one of my sort of earliest... I don't say influences, but anyway, I loved his stuff, the columns he wrote for Punch and the Times and stuff. He never did stand-up, of course, but he was on the News Quiz and he was brilliant at that as well. And he had that great thing of having a huge vocabulary, but the laugh would be delivered with the shortest, most Anglo-Saxon term. You know, that was where it came back to ground.
Yes, that's because your stuff in particular is so kind of flavoured with those kind of word choices.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, I suppose the fact that it is quite, there is a sort of middle class thing to it that people might just then start to associate with a degree of pretension, you know, a bit of fish knives kind of, you know, and doilies, a bit of that sort of middle class, you know, seeking for status. So, I mean, again, that's where I'm interested in the... in the generational divide as well, that cycle thing, you know, what were things like 40 years ago when I was the age my son is now? And that's usually best delivered by going back to some less, you know, some less trendy language, some less current sort of flavoured forms, you know.
Are you successful?
Yes, but... I think if I'd been shown, you know, my career 20 years ago, this is where you'll get to, I'd have to say yes, but you never quite enjoy it, do you? It's ridiculous. I've had some years where I've earned lots of money, but it always seems to be that you just spend the following year catching up with the tax bill. you never quite feel that you're safe from exposure as a fraud. I think that's the thing, isn't it? You just don't know, and you just think it could all be smoke and mirrors. And so it's not like having a successful business, you know, with a fleet of cars or with a lease on a, you know, it's so ephemeral. It could all just vanish so suddenly. And so objectively, I have to think this has been a successful career so far, but it doesn't feel like it's finished yet, and so it could all retroactively disappear.
Do you have any plans for retirement ever?
No, I have none.
Great answer. Me neither, Jesus. Yes. What's funny about you?
A certain sort of brittle, old-fashioned, out of touchness, you know, with the modern world, a sort of cross-grain irreconcilability with popular trends.
Who do you feel you are secretly like? What other comedian?
I'm more like Stuart Lee than I'm comfortable with. Stuart is obviously a great comedian and widely admired, but he's very left and he's very deconstructionist and he's very sort of into, you know, obscure indie bands and you know, weird abstract jazz and so on, and people wouldn't think that. But in terms of how I construct material, not so much his more recent stuff, where he really does play endlessly with the audience's patience. I don't do that so much, but his earlier stuff, when he was more of a club comic and in, I have absorbed quite a lot of his craft. I do sometimes realise, after I've been doing a routine for a while, this is a bit like Stuart's routine about X, you know. So I've noticed that. I've absorbed more of him than you might think.
What do you think most holds you back?
Indecision and procrastination, I would think.
He answered immediately and deftly. What is the bit that you are most proud of?
God, that is a good question. I did, I mean, in the early days, it was definitely the Geordie bit, which was huge. And I was proud of how it had flourished like a coral reef, but it was kind of cumbersome and ridiculous. There were a couple of moments in the Welsh routine, which zigzagged back and forth quite pleasingly. I always think that's, I mean, Woody Allen's Moose routine, which is, you know, held up often as the, you know, the kind of perfect, in terms of verbal dexterity, it has that kind of turns on a sixpence thing. Every third word takes you in a new direction and surprises you. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. But I think it might be the Shackleton bit, actually, just because it was so sort of unpromising, really. And yet I managed to get the audience to see what it was that I found so kind of funny about. So funny about the changes in our standards, what to look like, you know, and what people used to put up with. And I managed to communicate this quite subtle thing. If you're doing, you can do great jokes, but if the idea of what it is you're finding funny is fairly straightforward, then however good the bit is, it's not that subtle, you know what I mean? It's when you're communicating something that's quite a subtle idea and you still get a big belly laugh out of it, that's really satisfying, I think.
Brilliant. Last two. Review yourself, honestly.
Review myself?
Yes, if you were to write it, just a two-line review for, if you were knowing what you know about you.
Okay, of my current show, you mean?
Not current show.
Okay.
Oh, it's more, no, not your current show, you right. As a comic. You perform your comedy set in front of you, the reviewer.
Oh, God.
And what do you have to say about it?
God, it's very difficult to say. I suppose I would say Evans is a relaxed and assured performer who knows how to elicit laughs from the toughest of audiences. However, there is a suspicion that at the back of his mind, he too knows that this absurd persona will one day surely be rendered redundant by the pressures of evolving society.
Very good, very good, very immediate. And uniquely, you referred to yourself by your surname, which I think is absolute comedy mileage there. Finally, are you happy?
As a comedian or just as a person? I'm not, I'm balanced, I think, but I can certainly experience moments of extraordinary frustration. But they are usually to do with being stuck in traffic on a train or in the house, unable to get to where I'm going. Once I'm in the kind of environment that I enjoy, like this, a conversation or performing or doing any of the things that I know that I like to do, then I'm fine.
Thanks, Simon. So that was Simon. Thank you very much to him for coming along. Thank you to Nathan Wood for producing this episode. Thank you to Matt Hoss for logging it. Thank you to everyone at Angel Comedy at the Bill Murray Pub for the recording space. And thank you to you on this happy occasion, episode 250 of this project that has been going on, suddenly I realise, for 6 years and has brought me enormous meaning. It's frequently made me very happy. It's frequently made me very tense. It still continues to make me worry about my ability to keep churning out. Even the word churning is the wrong word, but my fear that I'll simply churn stuff out, but it and my worries that it will keep being good. I think I'm getting even better at it. I am next year going to not go to the Edinburgh Festival. Well, I mean, I'll probably go. It'll be my year off. So next year, I'm talking 2019. It'll be a year off, and I will probably not spend all year writing a new show for it, but maybe I'll do something up there of some sort. I wouldn't be surprised. But what I'm going to do with my year is in the comedian's year starts in September, and you know, that's when you start going, God, I've got to do it all again now. I've got to write another show. I don't think I'm going to tour next year. I don't think I'm going to write a new Edinburgh show. I may break either of those plans. But what I am going to do is try and grow the podcast. And I'm going to try to just turn the dial up on the amount of effort that already goes into it. I'm going to try and get over some of my anxieties about booking bigger name guests. One of my things, listen, I go into this in detail in the extra content, but I think my anxiety at research is it holds me back, because, look, I really want Johnny Vegas on the pod. He's agreed to do it. I've got his agent's number. It's just a case of setting it up. But I haven't yet found the time to read his book. And when you get an act of that stature who's written a brilliant book, you can't interview until you've read his book. But that's a good example of a thing I absolutely should do and get around to doing. But and I'm sure I'll regret saying this later, as I'm letting you in slightly too much. But with acts who have just years' worth of material out there, of sitcoms that I need to watch and all the rest of it, it just cripples me and I get anxious, and then I end up not inviting them on or not getting round to ringing because I worry about my ability to do the perfect job. So that is on my list of things to nail in September and to get over, and make sure that I spend the next year really having the time to focus on growing the podcast. So I hope you will continue to listen for the next 250 episodes as things change and grow and all of that stuff. There's some new music coming our way soon as well, some new theme music, which I can't wait to hear the next draft of, and possibly some new graphics and, you know, twiddly stuff like that. But ultimately, and this is probably instead of a post-amble or rather than as well as, I just want to thank everybody. I've been doing this I feel like I've done this a lot, but I suppose the last few years have been very good to me. Not only has the podcast afforded me a lot of, that's what I was saying, yes. Not only does it make me very anxious and stressed and tired, but it gives me enormous meaning. it really makes sense of my life. And my stand-up shows are always an attempt. I think art is an attempt to make sense of the world, right? Which sounds pretty clever, but I only think that because I read it in some unattributed source at college. It's all an attempt to make sense of the world. And my shows are always an attempt to make sense of the world and myself and my place in it and my emotions. And if you've come along to the tour, there's a few left of those. If you're around in London, you can go to the Soho Theatre website or go to comedianscomedian.com/tour to find out about those ones. Cardiff is coming up still as well, and Tring. If you've come along to the tour, or if you've ever seen my stand-up live, you'll know, not just clips, but like a solid, you know, a show, you will know that it's all an attempt to make sense of something. And this podcast, it occurs to me of late, has been a huge part of me making sense of what I am in the world. And for that, and for all of your kind attention and your emails and your communication and your tweets and the times when you've walked up to me and pressed cash into my hand and said something cool, or more likely had a brief but invigorating conversation about what the podcast means to you, for all of those things, I thank you. 250 episodes. Lovely. What a lovely... Is it a real milestone? I went all soppy at 200. I'm sure I'll go soppy again at 300. But 250. I keep wanting to say quarter century, but it isn't, is it? The quarter century times 10. It is everything and nothing. It's just the numbers ticking around, isn't it? I always think that when you have a big birthday. I used to stress out about my birthdays. And then I realised that all it is, it's just the same as when you watch the numbers tick round on a digital clock and you see that, oh, it's 12, 34 and 54 seconds. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Oh, coo. You know, kuh. That's all a birthday is, isn't it? You just go, oh, look, the numbers have ticked around. So it's everything and nothing. And why not take the opportunity to thank you all for your continuing patronage and financial support in some cases. Do join the Insiders Club. I'm really having a lot of fun with the hardcore. Strictly for the hardcore, as the Happy Sideshow used to say. That takes me back. There we go. 250 episodes. Lots more to come. I hope another 200. I hope another 750. Maybe when I get to 1,000, I might pack it in. Maybe not. It's really fun talking to people, and it's really fun listening to my guests and talking at you. These bits are very therapeutic, as you can probably hear, by which I mean they have no value. I don't mean that about therapy. What I mean is they have no entertainment value. Thank you for listening. And next, we've got some just belters. Robin Ince coming up. That's almost a two-parter. Paul Foote, 40 minutes of dense, quasi-impenetrable stuff about the science of comedy and the maths involved in his writing. That's going straight on the extras, because to the casual listener, it will be so abstruse. So, God, have I said that word out loud? That's a very Stephen Fry sort of a word. I think I mean that word. Nick Thune still to come. K. Trevor Wilson from over a year ago. Sorry, K. Trev, we'll get that out as soon as we can. Raymond and Timkins, Edinburgh coming up. John Luke Roberts and some other exciting non-white male guests that are currently booked. There's been a bit of a dearth of non-white, non-men recently, and I'm always keen to rectify that. So don't worry, I am aware of that. And I'm taking steps to diversify it up a little bit and get back in line with the normal custom at the podcast. So that's that. Wow, there we go. Extra content at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. I'll see you over there in the Slack app workspace channel. Talk about impenetrable. Who even knows what that is? You'll know if you sign up and get the sexy email that makes you feel part of the cool gang and gives you various links to places where you can communicate with other members of the cool gang. And if you're unable to support the show financially, then of course, thank you for all of your likes, tweets, retweets, subscribes, comments, and all the times you've told a stranger or a friend, probably a friend, probably unlikely a stranger, but extra points if you tell a complete stranger at random in a bus stop queue about the Comedian's Comedian podcast, and or did a thing on iTunes or Podcast Addict or Pocket Cast or Downcast or all the other cast things. Someone used the word cast referring to... if you listened this long, here's a treat. I think I can announce this. At the King's Place Podcast Festival, which is in October. Is it? Or September? September, October. It's after Edinburgh, so it exists in a completely different space to me. The London Podcast Festival at King's Place on the Sunday night in the headliner slot in a 400-seater. I am happy to announce here and officially that I will be interviewing, my guests will be, all four of the No Such Thing as a Fish podcast crew. So bloody well get involved and get your tickets for that. That is going to be absolutely enormous. I can't wait to get those very funny QI elves onto the show. If you've not heard No Such Thing as a Fish, you don't need me to tell you about it. It's one of the biggest podcasts in the country. But it's the QI elves talking about their favourite, introducing to each other their favourite real facts and being very funny about them. So that is going to be a huge amount of fun. And that's that. Now that I've remembered that I have other promotional things to do, my Edinburgh show is at 2:50 every day at the Liquid Rooms Warehouse, which is off Cowgate in Edinburgh, every day during the festival, from the first Saturday to the final Sunday, apart from Thursday the 16th. Yes, radical. Goldsmith takes off the middle Thursday. Who does that? Someone who's been to Edinburgh for 25 years, that's who. So come along and see it. It's called End Of. And you can join the Facebook group or look on my Stuart Goldsmith Comedian Facebook page and you can see the very sexy new artwork courtesy of Matt Crockett and Daniel England. So that's that. I mean, that is that. I've said that's that several times, but that is that. Is it? Yes, it's that. Speak to you soon.